dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. Though politicians are the leaders of record in our society, the people who make the decisions that have the most impact on most people's lives are those who dominate the economic rather than political realm. They tend to control rather than be controlled by political leaders. And thus, the same solutions that don't really work for most of us are implemented and re-implemented. Why? Because these solutions do work for the small group of people that determine the economic life of the nation and the world. We'll begin by looking at our own nation and region, then shift to a discussion of Argentina, which presents both the worst-case scenario of where we are headed, as well as innovative solutions that could be implemented if we demanded them. We'll begin the program with a panel discussion on wealth, class, and America's role in the world that was held in Auburn, New York on April 28th and sponsored by the Cayuga Peace Coalition. Guy Cosentino, former mayor of Auburn, moderated the panel of three local experts. The first speaker was Naeem Inatullah, Associate Professor of Political Science from Ithaca College.
But I have a title for this talk, and it's called We Have All Been Here Before, and it's from the Crosby, Stills, and Nash song, right? We have all been here before, we've all been here before. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the British in India, a little bit about capitalism, a little bit about socialism, a little bit about U.S. foreign policy, and then conclude. Let me start with the British in India, the British Empire. And one of the things that we may not know is that the French and the British were competing with each other in 1790 in South Asia. And the British eventually won that fight against the French. And between 1790 and 1830, they had two basic projects. One was a missionary conversion of the Indians to Christianity. And the second was an attempt to civilize the Indians through education. And the idea was that once this happened, that the British would then leave. So one of the questions that we could ask ourselves is, why this project of conversion? Why this project to civilize and to educate? And there's sort of two answers for that. One is what's known by some theorists as the postulate imperative, which in everyday language goes like this. One has the right and the duty to teach others when one knows something that's important to teach others, right? But there's also a second project that's going on here, and a little bit more interesting as far as I'm concerned, and that's working through analogy or through experiment, which is the idea that one works on others as a way of working on oneself. So it's sort of an outside-inside kind of project. So briefly, doing elsewhere to others what can't be accomplished at home, what cannot be accomplished at home. So then, after you've accomplished it overseas in a colony, then you bring it back home to the empire. So this is not the key theme of what I'm going to try and say, is the relationship between the outside and the inside, and I'll come back to that. Let me go back to India for a second. By 1830s, these policies of Christianization and civilization were in full effect. There was some resistance, which wasn't much noticed by the British. In 1857, there was what's known in the history books as the Mutiny, and what's known in India as the First War of Independence. It was a spontaneous uprising of Indian troops, Muslims and Hindus, against their white commanders. And it was all over the country. And there were quite a few British killed, but not very many, in relative standards, maybe 100 or 200, something like that. What's interesting about this so-called mutiny is the British response, both by the policymakers and by the general public, because the British response to this so-called mutiny was complete and total outrage. The British were in complete disbelief as to how the natives could be so ungrateful for the material provisions that the empire gave them, for railroads, for example, canals, for example. the social infrastructure that the empire provided, the bureaucracy, for example, and the civilizing mission that I'm talking about, you know, education and Christianity. The result of this incredible outrage in the British press and the British public was that there was a demand for a swift and brutal response that was completely out of proportion. In retrospect, as we look at history, completely out of proportion with what was actually happening there. But along with that brutal response was also an ideational response. The British came to believe that the natives could not be civilized, could not be Christianized, could not be educated, and therefore that the British must remain in India as the guardians of the Indians, basically permanently. And that became basically official policy. Now, there's three things I want you to notice about that little synopsis of history that I'm trying to give you there. The first is that the temporary civilizing project turns into the permanent imperial project. The second is that the racist and imperialist nature of the British view towards Indians was never far from the surface. It only took more or less a relative minor provocation to produce that racist response. And the third is that what could not be achieved in India, remember the project was to civilize and Christianize and to educate these people, what could not be achieved in India also therefore had to be abandoned for the British themselves, for their own Indians, the working classes, the working minorities, women. So rather than being brought up to civilization, the elites would have to permanently guard over them. The ruling class would have to be the permanent guardians of those who did not have what it took to rise up to civilization, whether that was outside in India or inside within Great Britain. So those are the sort of three things I wanted you to notice about this little lesson in British history. Okay, let me catch my breath there for a second and talk a little bit about capitalism. And I want to distinguish between what capital is and what capitalism is, at least in my understanding of it. Capital, I don't have much of a problem with. The use of it's in my world, it's the use of wealth in order to produce more wealth, especially in the investment in technological change in order to create more wealth. You know, when a farmer saves some seed in order to use it in the next season, that's a form of capital. It's a very primitive form, but it's nevertheless a form of capital. So there's nothing inherently wrong with the idea of capital itself. Capitalism, on the other hand, is a system where capital can be privately owned and where the decisions about how to deploy that capital are left in the hands of those who actually own the capital. And historically, we know that that's usually a very small minority. So let me do a little bit more on capitalism itself. We often hear that life does not owe us a living, that we have to earn our keep. But this wasn't actually always true. In feudal times and in pre-capitalist cultures, the community had an obligation to meet the requirements of all its members. And if the community did not, or if the ruler of that community did not, then overthrow was a legitimate response. It's only in capitalism, it seems to me, that one is free to become destitute, free to die from destitution. Now, proponents of capitalism cite this as capitalism's greatest power. The market coerces each individual to meet the needs of others in order to meet one's own needs. Or to put it in reverse, to meet one's own needs, you have to provide the needs of others. The market, they argue, provides great wealth because of this unforgiving quality. Now, I want to propose that it is this aspect of the market, its ability to bring everyone in line with the needs of others, that the current elites of the United States wish to use as a manner of civilizing other human beings across the world. But as I tried to indicate earlier, the target is both external and internal. This is where that inside-outside theme comes in handy. The target is external and it's internal. And I think these elites are making a potential miscalculation in their logic, but I'll come to that in just a minute. Let me talk instead a little bit first about socialism. And I'm borrowing this from one of my favorite theorists of socialism, who is Karl Polanyi. And the idea here is that there's this big S, capital S socialism, which is, you know, the countries, for example, Vietnam or Cuba or China. But there's also what we might call small s socialism, where things like collective bargaining, minimum wage, child labor laws, overtime, unemployment insurance, and the list could go on and on, I'm sure. And what we could sort of paraphrase this and call this the social security net. Now, Karl Polanyi argues that without this net, this social security net, capitalism wouldn't have lasted more than 20 years. And the reason is that the disenfranchised would revolt, producing a revolution, bringing down the whole edifice. And in his argument, therefore, socialism, small s socialism, rather than being opposed to capitalism actually is what allows capitalism to work. Okay, I find that a very interesting idea. And I'll come back to that idea in a minute. Let me quickly turn to U.S. foreign policy. In my view, the events of September 11th are much like the Indian Mutiny of 1857. These were the provocations that brought to the surface the imperial project. The current imperial project is moved by the ideology of Christian salvation and by the faith of an unfettered market economics. The target of that ideology is twofold: the Indians outside, Afghans, Iraqis, Syrians, North Koreans, etc., etc., etc. But the Indians inside are also the target, the working classes and their hard-won gains against the cold indifference of market forces and the hard hearts of capitalists. If I had to pick which of these targets is closer to the bullseye of current U.S. foreign policy, I would say that it's the less noticed target, the internal Indian, the working classes of this country. Now, let me turn to the miscalculation, I think, that the elites in this country are making. If Polanyi is correct, and that's sort of a big if, we could talk about it. If Polanyi is correct, then the current U.S. foreign and domestic policy will create two effects. One effect is that it will increase resistance to the evangelizing project of market forces. And the second effect, I think, the second result, if unintended, is that if we wreck small socialism, then it will have the unintended consequence of undermining capitalism itself. Of course, not without doing untold damage to all the cultures of this planet, the resisting cultures of this planet, which, in my view, are the resources where our salvation actually lies. So, having said that, let me see if I can... I know that's a whirlwind, right? Fast, right? But let me try and close with a couple of comments as well. If this picture is anywhere near being accurate, then the question is, what can we do? At the deepest level, the elites and the capitalists buy our middle-class allegiance. They pay for it. They buy it. We are the house slaves in the master's plantation. You know, Harry Belafonte has come out strongly with this talk about house slaves and field slaves directed at Colin Powell, so I'm going to use that same metaphor. We, the working classes and the middle classes of this country, are the house slaves in the master's plantation. And I, for one, am grateful for not having to toil under the midday sun. But we also can ask ourselves a couple of pointed questions. Why is it that we tend to give our allegiance to the master? Can we find ways to align ourselves to the field slaves and the Indians, who most of us may shortly become anyway? We'll end up going from the house into the field shortly if these kinds of policies continue in any case. To be a little bit less abstract, I'm suggesting that to align ourselves with current U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy is to remain addicted to the illusion that we have everything to teach and nothing to learn, because we are God's and history's chosen people. There is a difference between a patriotism that basks in the glory of being the world's only superpower and the patriotism that sees this culture as one among many, with something to offer and something to learn from others. I think that until we recognize these different forms of patriotism, we are bound to remain the house slaves who praise the master's glory despite the fact that he enslaves us all. Now, I'm not under any illusion, myself, I hope, that I'm saying anything new or profound. In some senses, it's important to repeat the lessons of history. And so let me end with the title of this talk, in the sense that if you've heard this before, it's because we have all been here before. We have all been here before.
Professor Naeem Inatullah of Ithaca College. Our second speaker is Bashti Leo, president of the Cayuga County Labor Council and a fourth grade teacher at Seward Elementary in Auburn.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the work that labor is doing in Auburn and Cayuga County, New York State, and our sort of national agenda. And I'll start with some of the things that we've been looking at here in Cayuga County in terms of labor issues. I think instead of talking about wealth and class in America, what I'd like to do is focus on Auburn as a microcosm of America and upstate New York and the industrial belt, the kind of declining economic situation that's been going on for several years, decades even. currently, and I've been doing some research for another project, so I've been following the Bureau of Labor Statistics pretty carefully for the past couple of months. Auburn, the city of Auburn's employment rate is currently 7.1%. That's doubled since a year ago. So, and even having unemployment a year ago at like 3.6 is still pretty high when you consider Auburn's not, you know, a huge city. And we're just talking about the city of Auburn, not the entire county. County unemployment runs about 7% right now as well. So that's a really disturbing number. Most of those people who are currently unemployed and living in poverty are single mothers and children. Most of the people living in poverty in the city of Auburn right now are children. Many of them have parents or a parent who is working. So you have people who are working but not able to put the basics on the table. And as a labor community, we feel strongly that that's not right. That if you're working at a job, you should be able to provide the basics for your family. Christmas dinner, Easter dinners, you know, some presents along the way, you know, birthdays and such. But many, many families in this city are not able to do that despite the fact that they are working at a job. So looking at that, we're kind of trying to look at the sources of that. And, you know, Auburn historically has always been an industrial town. And for a variety of reasons, that kind of base has ebbed away. And so now we have a lot of low-wage jobs that aren't exactly what you'd call, you know, the kind of job where you work at it for a lifetime and you're going to have some kind of security when you retire. And a lot of what's happening in Cayuga County and the state and the nation is that many communities which are looking for some kind of tax base, some kind of jobs, look to kind of big box type businesses which come in from the outside and ask for tax abatements over several years. They're usually granted, and then everyone seems to think that that's going to solve the problem. But if you look at it a little more carefully, many of these kinds of big boxes are not providing jobs which pay enough to lift people off of social welfare. So on the one hand, you have a city or a county which is responsible for implementing anti-poverty programs such as WIC, et cetera, et cetera. And thank God they're there, because if they weren't, we'd have many children in this city who would not have any food to eat, period. And many of them, by the way, don't have any food to eat when the benefits run out in the middle of the month. And that leaves teachers like me scrounging around school for extra peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to send home. And I'm not exaggerating. So, or like me, when you see socks on sale, you buy an extra pack, because then you have them for the kids at school who come in the winter with no socks and their feet are soaking wet. Okay? So we have a real issue in this town with poverty. And at any rate, I digress. So you have a community that's responsible, its government is responsible for implementing anti-poverty programs. By the same token, by granting a tax abatement to a big box employer or any employer, that money has to be made up somewhere, and that's coming out of your pocket and mine, just like the money for the anti-poverty program. So now I'm paying out of both pockets, as it were. My dollar's going one way and then it's going this way. And what's the big box paying? Right now, maybe less, maybe 6 years down the road is when they're supposed to pay a fuller portion. And that I don't, and that's not really the abatement per se that we as a labor community have an issue with. Our issue is we feel there's a low road to economic growth, and I just described that. And then we feel there's a high road to economic growth, where labor, the citizenry, the business community, and the government all work together to look at what would be the best way to grow this community. If we're going to look at tax abatements, what kind of business should get tax abatements? Should it be a company like Bombardier, which provides really pretty good paying jobs, or McQuay, which pays a living wage, or should we be looking more towards something like a Walmart or a Kmart? So it's really a question of considering it very carefully. And many communities are now saying, well, yes, we will grant you that tax abatement. However, you know, we're going to ask that you provide a certain level of job and that you, you know, that we continue to stay in contact about that and how the workers are being treated. So we're sort of trying to raise that level on, of debate in the city and in the county and at a national level. So, and there is a board that, and our, it meets out of Cortland, workforce investment boards, which were established under the Clinton administration by law, and they're all over the country, they're regional, which looks at just that issue. How can you develop a community economically, but also do it responsibly in a way that works for the community and lifts people out of poverty and off of social welfare? So we're really talking about how to bring decent jobs into a community in a way that works for the business community and works for the citizenry and the working people. The second issue that we're looking at locally and nationally is taking a look at how workers are treated in these big box employers. And I've done a tremendous amount of research on Walmart lately, so I'm just going to talk about that for a minute. Walmart is, first of all, a notoriously anti-union employer, almost like fanatically so. There was a video made, a documentary, which interviewed former Walmart managers and supervisors, and it's like almost, it's a paranoia anti-unionism. In other words, if you even breathe anything about union, you are fired, period. If you are known to have relatives who are in a union, you might very well be followed at work and eavesdropped upon and perhaps fired. They force employees to sit in what's called a captive audience meeting, which is illegal, where you're forced like two or three people to sit and listen to the boss's anti-union message, but and you're not allowed to leave. Those are a violation of federal law. And more sort of startling than that is that in 40 states, Walmart has been censured by the Labor Department for violation of wage and hours laws, whereby workers are locked in to the store, they're told to clock out, they are locked in, not allowed to leave until they finish a quota of work. Quotas are illegal under federal law. Locking people in is illegal under federal law. And forcing people to work without pay is a violation of federal law. And Walmart has been found in violation of this in 40 states. And we find that fairly alarming. Secondly, Walmart has been censured, again, in over 40 states for violations of EEOC, Equal Opportunity Employment Laws. They are currently the subject of the largest class action lawsuit ever brought in the United States for violations of hiring and promotion practices and violation, specifically discrimination against women and people of color. It's a huge lawsuit. So we're looking at some things that we feel like people who live in this country ought to be fairly concerned about, since that's not, I don't think any of us have that as the image of what we'd like America to be about. So we're kind of looking at some of those issues. The other thing about Walmart is, you know, they always say often to get into a community and to get tax abatements, they'll say, well, we give benefits. Well, they do and they don't. They do offer the benefit, but you have to pay for it yourself. And we did the Labor Council some math and figured out that if you were a single person working at Walmart full time for the, you know, minimum wage, after you took out for the insurance for your own self, you would have $80 in take-home pay every 2 weeks. So we don't really feel like anyone could live on that. So what happens is, again, you have people working for a living but relying on social services in order to take care of health care for their children, and then often the adult goes without and they wind up in emergency rooms, which, you know, Medicaid pays for. And again, that comes out of our pocket eventually. So, you know, we're sort of saying, listen, we don't have a problem with capitalism at all, you know, but we do have a problem with the way that workers are treated. And when you come into my community from Arkansas or wherever you came from, yeah, I think it matters to the citizens how their brothers, their sisters, their children are treated. When my students leave Auburn High School or they graduate from CCC or whatever they do, or they drop out of high school or whatever happens, or they get their GED, I would hope that when they go to work, they're not locked in and forced to work off the clock. I would really hope for that, you know, and I think that as people who live in the community, we should stand up and say something about that. You know, we live here. This is our community. These companies have come in from elsewhere. I think there needs to be a certain amount of corporate responsibility. And just as a PS, and then I'll leave Walmart, Walmart makes a profit in excess of $1 billion per day. But yet, they will not pay their workers to complete the work of the day. You know, or they will indiscriminately lay people off simply because they don't want to pay any more money that month for personnel. And so people are just laid off without any notice, goodbye, you're gone. So, you know, I think that, and I guess the Walton family, someone told me that each member of the Walton family, I think a $3 or $4 billion bonus at the end of last year, their income. But yet, we have people in Auburn working at Walmart, barely making it, going to the Christmas elf to get presents for their kids. We have a problem with that. And I would think that the community should have a problem with that. And then lastly, I just want to talk about kind of America in the world today. As a labor community, nationally and internationally, we feel really strongly about the issue of offshore production, and that many companies have moved their businesses to Mexico or Burma or Cambodia or wherever they've gone. Guatemala is another big one, Dominican Republic. And this is particularly an issue with clothing and shoes. Those items are made in factories which are really abhorrent and harken back to things that went on in this country in the 1890s and early 1900s, you know, triangle shirtwaist fire kind of stuff. The women who work in these factories are often threatened at gunpoint, raped, not allowed to leave for the bathroom or for any reason whatsoever. Their children come and sit under the sewing machines under the table until they're 10 or 12, and then they start working in the factory. And this is where our clothes are coming from. Walmart's items, for instance. Kmart, Target, I mean, all of it. You can't, even the fanciest designers, you really can't get away from sweatshop manufactured items, which is really too bad. Because even if you want to, it's very difficult to get away from it. So our issue is, should the profits of American companies be made on the backs of women and children who are being held at gunpoint in other countries or working in abhorrently dirty and awful, terrible conditions? You know, as a labor community, we feel like we have people right here in America who need jobs, who will work. And when you talk about spending billions of dollars to rebuild Iraq, God bless them, but I think we need some rebuilding done here. And that doesn't necessarily represent the views of the AFL-CIO, but it is something that I think takes a good, long, hard look. So you have to wonder, and talk about America's role in the world, how... You know, if American companies are treating people that way overseas, I wonder, you know, why is it that other countries are afraid we're going to come in and occupy and oppress them? Well, because corporate America has, in fact, been doing that economically, and you know, we're benefiting from it. So that's an issue that I think requires some thought. So that's really what we're looking at right now on the Labor Council, and what AFL-CIO is looking at right now coming into the next round of elections and next legislative piece of work that has to be done. So that's really, really all I have to say about the topic, but I look forward to hearing people's comments.
Thank you much. Professor Clickard from Wells.
Thank you. Another thing about Walmart is they're right now the country's biggest seller of compact discs. And, you know, I'm not a real big fan of country music, but I have been thinking of dropping by to get a Dixie Chicks record. And, you know, our president now, even though he wasn't elected, I mean, you have to, he didn't get as many votes as the other candidate, but he did have a brother that appointed the election commissioner, and he did have a father that appointed the Supreme Court justices that said the election commissioner doesn't have to count the votes. It's basically, although it's not America's first non-elected president, that title, of course, falls to Gerald Ford, It was America's first judicial coup d'etat. And, you know, but he is the president, and a while ago he made a statement that the war in Iraq is not about oil. You know, that's kind of like arguing, and many people made this argument back in the 1850s and the 1860s, that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. And while there are a lot of other things going wrong, those two statements have something in common. I think they're both wrong. But the war in Iraq and American foreign policy is about some other things. Admittedly, something that our current president's daddy had some trouble with. He kept calling it the vision thing. And it's about American foreign policy, specifically very unilateral foreign policy, from isolating Cuba to repudiating the Kyoto Protocol on global warming to the simply ignoring the United Nations and making war on Iraq to who knows where next, perhaps Syria. It's about a lot more. So I want to go back to the vision thing for a second and look at the vision, not so much the political vision, but the vision of multinational corporations, places, things like, oh, to name one example, Walmart, or Nike shoes, or say something like the Bechtel Corporation, the world's largest engineering and construction firm, the world's most secretive corporations, because all their stock is privately owned and they don't file any documents with the Securities and Exchange Commissions. And I think if you look at their visions, there's two visions they have. That every place in the world shall become middle-class American consumers. And so if there's some kind of cultural norms that you have to get rid of in order to sell kind of world products on the world market, then get rid of those. I mean, the Japanese culture depends upon a certain kind of rice. Don't worry about it. They can eat Uncle Ben's. And the other problem is that there shall not be any barriers anywhere from moving money wherever you want to move it to get the fastest and highest rate of return. So if you want to close down an auto factory in Los Angeles where people make about $30 an hour with benefits, move it to Mexico where they have much better technologies and make much better cars and except get $10 a day. There shouldn't be anything that stands in the way of that. I think that's the vision they're looking at. And the result of that has been a tremendous rise in the inequality that we see in the world. And it's my belief that inequality and poverty breed hatred. And hatred breeds war and it breeds terrorism. So if we're serious about doing something about terrorism, we need to do something about inequality. Now, Mr. Cosentino said that I was an economist, and he's correct. And that means upon getting my degree, I've got to swear an oath of allegiance that every time I say something publicly, I've got to put some numbers in it. So, back in 1994, a woman who worked at a place called the World Watch Institute, who was if anybody saw the film Cadillac Desert that appeared on PBS, it was she who did that. But before she was working on water, she was working on population and the relation of kind of world population and policy. And she cranked out, she went to the World Bank. I mean, hardly a socialist institution. One of those things that was created at the end of the Second World War when the world went off the gold standard and replaced it with dollars and that they had to have some institutions to to regulate the dollar. So she went back and looked at the World Bank's numbers and found that in 1960, she divided all the world's countries up into five equal groups and looked at what the rich were getting and looked what the poorest fifth were getting. And the richest fifth took about 70% of the world's income, and the poorest fifth got about 2.3, and the ratio was 30 to 1. And then we went through the Great Society, and we also went through the Vietnam War. And at the middle of the Vietnam War, right after the Tet Offensive, she recranks the numbers, and about 74% goes to the richest fifth, and about still, 2.3% goes to the poorest fifth. But since the top's going up, the ratio goes up, and it's now 32 to 1. Then the economy of the United States just hits the dumpster in the 1970s. We slow way down, we stagnate, but for those at the very top, things were getting a little bit better, because now the richest fifth are getting about 77%, and the poorest fifth are getting real poor. They're down to about 1.7%, and the ratio goes up to 45 to 1, and then the last year that she's got numbers for is 1989, and the richest 20% are getting 83%, and the poorest 20% are getting 1.4%. Now the ratio is close to 60 to 1. Last year, a biologist who's probably the country's foremost expert on biodiversity, a guy named Edward Wilson, recalculates the numbers and says the ratio is now 75 to 1. So in the world, things are getting more unequal. And that count, and those numbers count everybody who's in a rich country as rich. But last time I looked at it, everybody who's in a rich country isn't rich. Even rich countries have poor people. But the standards for poverty are really very different. And by any measure that economists love to use, economists have about 10 measures of inequality. They're all getting worse. And so if you go back and look at the numbers, you go way back to the Great Society, and you go through the end of the Johnson administration, and then Richard Nixon takes over, and every year of the Nixon administration gets a little bit more unequal than any year of the Johnson administration. Then we, kind of muddle through the feckless Ford administration, and Jimmy Carter gets elected president, and he just won the Nobel Peace Prize, but guess what? Every year of the Carter administration is more unequal than any year of the Nixon administration. And then Ronald Reagan stands up. I remember watching him. I went to graduate school in New Hampshire. It's the nation's first primary. Ronald Reagan stands up and says, "For America to get richer, the rich have to get richer." And he makes good on his promise. And every year of the Reagan administration, inequality grows, and then Bush's vice president gets a dirty trickster and outdoes Michael Dukakis and gets 4 years of president, has a 90% approval rating after a war in Iraq, but somehow mysteriously loses to a very liberal-sounding politician named Bill Clinton. But guess what? Every year of the Clinton administration is more unequal than any year of the Reagan or the first Bush administration. You begin to think there's some dynamic that's independent from politicians. But just to keep the pattern going, every year of the Bush administration is more unequal than, or the Bush Light administration is more unequal than any year of the Clinton administration. So we have this profound, and it's not just going on here. Things are getting more unequal in Sweden. Things are getting more unequal in Norway. Things are getting more unequal in the Netherlands. Things are getting more unequal in Japan. There seems to be a trend that's going all over the world. It's not quite enough that we're a little bit more unequal. of course, the current administration has a plan to make things a little bit more unequal, the way that they've always redistributed income. There's two ways. You do it through the market. You have a different tax on people who make income through property than you do for people who make income through work. So if you look back, I understand that there used to be this thing called a stock market boom. And if you look over the whole time, they went about 15 years, about 60% of all those stock market gains were appropriated by 1% of the population. And 55% of the gains were appropriated by one half of 1% of the population. During that same time, while prices rise, the minimum wage stayed put. And so at the very bottom, while executive compensation goes up by 350%, wages at the bottom go up by 0.2%. It seems to drive. But our president keeps saying that Americans should be able to keep more of their hard-earned money, as if getting interest off your bond portfolio is hard work. Okay, assume that it is. Said he now has a plan for a $750 billion tax cut, of which 42% will go to the top 1% of Americans. But he won't win it. He'll be forced to settle for $500 billion. He'll get that through. And so we can do that. And then we'll whittle away a little bit at the safety net, that small s socialism that Carl Polanyi talked about. But you know, I think usually the safety net whittles away where I can't see it. You know, where I'm living in Manlius and teaching in Aurora can't see it. It tends to whittle away in distant countries, tends to whittle away in poor parts of cities, tends to whittle away in isolated rural communities. People manage to borrow money to stay even. Interesting factoid I heard, that now fully one-third of all credit card profits come from late fees. Like I said, you know, sometimes you get that wonderful choice in this country. Capitalism always brings choice. You get the choice between late fees and bounce fees. But things are much better in this country, because if you look at what it means to be poor in this country, I don't know if anybody knows how they calculate the poverty line. Back in the early 1960s, a woman named Molly Orshansky, who's working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, says she looks through generations of home economic studies and comes up with the idea that people spend about 25% of their income on food, year after year after year. And she does all kinds of very reputable statistics and comes up with that. So she says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put together a food budget, and then I'll multiply it by four, and that'll be the poverty line. And so she puts together four budgets: an economy budget, which is just essentially calories, no vegetables, not much fresh food, just a low-income budget, which has at least got some canned vegetables, a moderate budget, and then a liberal one, which is the kind of diet sure to give you a heart attack if you eat it long enough, and goes to Congress and said, well, choose which one. And Congress, of course, chooses the economy one, because if they choose a higher level, then more of the poor are working poor. But you want all the poor to be dependent poor, because if you're supposed to get out of poverty by working, but there's still all these people working and they're still in poverty, this is an ideological problem. So they choose the lowest one. I don't know if anybody knows who Frances Moore LaPay is. She's been a food activist. She confronted then-President Reagan to say, you know, this is completely inappropriate. For instance, there's no vegetables in this economy budget. The president then said, well, sure there are. There's ketchup in here. Ketchup is a vegetable. One year for my birthday, I got this picture showing a bottle of ketchup and President Reagan, and said, which one is the real vegetable? even before being diagnosed. But here's the problem. If you take that idea and adjust it for changes in prices and everything, someone who is in poverty in this country makes about $9,000 a year. That's how they get the poverty line. The problem is that the U.S. standard of poverty is really different than the world standard of poverty. The United Nations standard of poverty says you're poor if you live on less than $2 a day, which is $730, and close to a third of the world's population, 2 billion people, live on $2 a day. A little over a billion people live on less than $1 a day. And so when we talk about U.S. poverty and we talk about world poverty, we're looking at dramatically different standards. And so I think really the vision of the Nikes and the Walmarts and the Bechtels and and not to single out Americans, but the Nestles and the Sonys and the Matsushitas and the Gold Stars, which is Korean, is that vision, you know, that process is going to keep going. But I think that process has got some limits. I think we've seen one of them with the rise of terrorism. I think we see some other limits just with environmental factors. If indeed the planet is fixed, if we keep growing, that eventually we're going to come close to those limits. I don't know how long we can go on. But one thing I do know, and I'll end with this, is that having so successfully defeated, or either that or abetted the implosion of big-ass socialism in the world and replaced it with this multinational vision and increasing levels of poverty, that there aren't very many viable alternatives to turn to other than U.S. unilateral foreign policy and the multinational vision. So this process has created a lot more disenfranchised, a lot more dispossessed people in the world who now no longer have like these viable socialist secular states to turn to and turn increasingly to these right-wing crackpots, be they the Taliban, who are actually better than the Mujahideen, or Osama bin Laden, or the cults in Japan. And I think, you know, for someone who lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis and lived through the Vietnam War, I figure having lived through Nixon and Reagan, someone in my privileged position will make it through the Bush administration okay. But I do think the world's becoming a more dangerous place. And I think more of the cause isn't the only solution.
And you were hearing the voice of Kent Klitgaard, Associate Professor of Economics at Wells College. Following the panelists' presentations, questions were taken from the audience and fielded by moderator Guy Cosentino.
And really to start off, and we had the history of the corporation and the issue of workers and items like that. And just back to something that Ms. Leo said really at the beginning in dealing with tax abatements, mm-hmm. Which is always a hot topic because there are those who say that you have to give whatever you can to land jobs. The city has taken a position, at least I can only speak till recently, of tying tax abatements to job creation. That if you don't have job creation, it levels over that 10, and usually they're 10 or 20-year pilots, payment in lieu of tax agreements, get rid of them. And I know that the question was asked, if they don't meet, maybe even to expand on that, if you don't meet it, we'll triple your taxes then, your property taxes then. Thoughts on that as well? And we can deal with all three and go, we'll start with you and go left to right from there.
Okay. Well, actually, it's an interesting question because in dealing with McQuay, which came in under a tax deal, the deal, however, was that McQuay would keep a steady employment of 700 employees. Two Christmases ago, right before Christmas, they laid off, I think, 123 workers. with no warning, like 3 days before Christmas. And as a labor council, we started looking back through the agreements and the paperwork, and yes, they were supposed to keep the employment at 700, and they had fallen far below that. They were down to like 500. Or they would be fined by the city, and that was signed on the dotted line. So off we went to the city attorneys and city council and da-da-da-da-da. And basically, you know, when they, you know, talked with McQuay about it, the leadership at McQuay said, well, then we're out of here. See ya. We're going to Mexico. So it's not worth the paper it's printed on, frankly, unless you have a citizenry and a government that's willing to pursue that, because in further research, I found out actually any citizen in that case could bring a lawsuit against that company because the government acted on the authorization of the electorate. But, you know, be that as it may, the point being, yes, you can put those kinds of things into place, but they're really not worth what they're printed on, because the company will just say, well, I'm out, you know, see ya, we're out of here. So, and actually McQuay did win another round of, abatements and tax deals as, you know, to stay. And they probably, the president of their union feels that they probably would have left without that. So it's a tightrope, and it's a really difficult tightrope. Would you rather deal with a McQuay that pays decent wages to unionized workers who have a say in their working conditions, or something like Bass Pro Shops? I don't know the answer to that, but that's really the tough place that we're in right now. The second one that I'll just address quickly has to do with wages linked to price increases. In other words, if you raise the wages of people, therefore you're going to have to pay more for the product. There has never, and I was recently listening to a discussion by an economist at Cortland, SUNY Cortland, and now I'm speaking in front of two actual economists, so I might be proven wrong. Who said that no empirical studies have ever proven that relationship to be quite so black and white, and that there's no real proof of that, and that secondly, recent studies done at Princeton and the Economic Policy Institute show that in communities where living wage laws have been passed or there have been increases in wages, there has not been a detrimental effect to prices, nor has it discouraged businesses from bidding on city contracts. In communities large and small, that has not been the case. Now, if you're talking about, you know, a large multinational corporation, and your workers in Auburn, New York, are having to compete with prison workers in China, that's a different question, a real different question. But I think in terms of your person who's bidding on the city contract to mow the lawn or what, I don't know, whatever it is, I think that's a different question. And there's really never been any research to show that there is a negative relationship there. And the last point on that is kind of just a philosophical question, in that why don't we ever ask that question about the highest paid executives in corporate America? Why don't we ever say, gee, you know, that multi-million dollar bonus might drive up prices. They shouldn't get paid that much. That might negatively impact prices. Why is it that the stewardesses and the guy who fixes the tire on your plane should have to take a 25% wage cut, and they turn around at the table and give the executives a 25% wage increase? And God bless those unions for finally taking a stand on that. So, you know, I mean, that's what I wonder, is why it never cuts both ways. But in terms of actual empirical studies, and two of you are probably going to tell me I'm wrong, it's my understanding that there's very little proof of that relationship being so direct.
Professor?
Well, seeing as I pulled up right behind her, we were probably listening to the exact same radio show.
Ithaca Hour.
Yes, Ithaca Hour, where both the two economists, Kenny Christensen and Howard Botwinick, are both friends of mine. So I absolutely agree with you there that this argument has come up so many times that if you raise the wages for the poorest people, it will hurt those that it's intended to help. And they made that argument back in the 1870s and the 1890s when they wanted, when unions wanted an 8-hour day. Oh, if you work 8-hour, that's not long enough. You'll get corrupted with all that time on your hands. It'll hurt you. No, but. And in the Depression, when they wanted to recognize unions and wage rates, it'll drive employment down. But hey, look, unemployment was already a problem in the Depression. They made the same argument when they wanted to raise the minimum wage the first time in 23 years. They finally raised the minimum wage, and guess what? Low-wage employment expanded. One of the things that Howard Botwinick, the person who said that on the radio, said is that a lot of these predictions, which are, you can do a lot of statistics and it's there in theory, are based on a theory that says people get paid what they deserve. And therefore, if you're a corporate executive and you get a 350% raise, you probably deserve it. And if you're making sub-minimum wage harvesting, well, you probably deserve it. But you know that people around here, even farm workers around here, make a lot more than minimum wage labor. That even McDonald's and Burger King are hiring in teenagers at more than minimum wage labor. And so actually a political increase in the minimum wage would actually just catch up to what's happening anyway. And whether or not people can pass those prices on has a lot more to do with, what's going on with their ability to sell things than their ability to cut costs. But those are kind of two different things. And so I don't see any automatic connection. I mean, you can draw a textbook diagram that says it's there, but if you actually test that in the real world, that there's not a lot of evidence that automatically links them.
And I think the other point is, I would, when you're talking about a very low wage job in which I'm paying essentially through my tax dollars to subsidize that low paying job. In other words, I'm paying through my tax dollars for the social programs, and I'm paying the money that the employer's not paying in a wage. I would rather, and I have no choice about that because I had to pay my taxes, or, well, I could choose to go to jail, I suppose, but I don't choose that. I would rather see the price of widgets go up, and I'll choose to buy the widgets or do without. Okay? Maybe I'll buy them, maybe I won't. And I'll choose that. I would rather see that than continue to be forced to make up for the poor salary of corporate America when I look at the distribution of wealth and I see that those who are at the top of that corporate ladder are making in excess of, who knows how much money. So, I kind of look at it as my tax dollar and where I would like to see it.
This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're hearing a panel on Wealth, Class, and America's Role in the World that was held in Auburn on April 28th. We continue.